The World Tomorrow, direct from a two-night personal appearance program in San Francisco. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's worldview and the prophecies of the world tomorrow. And now, Garner Ted Armstrong, as recorded at the first evening in San Francisco.
I was telling people just barely before the Yom Kippur War, and have been doing so for many, many years, that another renewed conflict could erupt in the Middle East, and this one would change the entire face of the earth. It would change conditions in all of the major nations of the world. And I was right about that, I believe, because the entire world has changed since the Yom Kippur War of 1973. And I was saying that eventually all of our concern over Vietnam is going to be paled into insignificance by our concern over what's going to be happening in the Middle East and in Europe. And I was doing that simply because of what Bible prophecy says. I don't know of any prophecy in the Bible that says anything at all about South Vietnam. I can't even identify South Vietnam, except in some broad sense of Asian peoples who might be mentioned in a prophecy in Ezekiel, in a broad general term of the hordes, you know, Oriental people, according to us in the Occident, are always running about in hordes. But you can't describe those people particularly. Since the Yom Kippur War of 1973, for all practical purposes, the world is a totally different place. I don't want to make this just another broadcast, but I want to rehearse briefly just how different it really is. It all began with the Arab oil embargo, then the quadrupling of Arab oil prices, which has sent the major industrial powers' economies into total chaos. I think you know something about balance of payments, that is, the difference that a nation might earn between imports and what she has to pay for those, and what she earns in exports that she sells to other countries. A nation such as India is a good case in point. The United States of America uses more fertilizer on our dichondra and our water grass than does India on all of its crops, and that's a fact. That is stated by a member of the federal government. We use an awful lot more pesticides and herbicides and anti-fungi chemicals and artificial fertilizers to have green lawns than they are able to afford for their crops in India. So here's a nation that suddenly has to pay four times as much for its oil. And oil is the base of the petrochemical industry from which comes herbicides and fungicides and, of course, even artificial fertilizers. Not only the oil of industry, the oil of shipping, the oil that is made into gasoline and other more exotic fuels like methane or butane or propane, but also the petrochemical industry, the plastics industry, the fabrics, the nylons, dacrons, orlons, and some of the other synthetics that we wear and use, and even building materials. And so here's a nation such as India that is at the poverty level anyhow, where 1% difference in national food production can mean literally that a million people or more die, and this is statistically demonstrated. I don't want to bother reading through all the reams of statistics I brought with me, but I did read through a number of them again to refresh my memory just prior to coming over here this evening. So suddenly, as a result of the quadrupling of oil prices, the balance of payments deficits in India began to build up enormously. They were going at the rate of $2 billion a month in Britain, $2 billion a month in Italy. So since the Yom Kippur War, that was in September of 1973, seems like a long time ago now, the economies of the entirety of the world have changed. Now, I would cite to you the very fact that many of you had never even heard of some of those Middle Eastern nations that are now in the news almost daily. Well, now all of a sudden, the wealth of the world is being moved systematically from Zurich, from London, from Paris, from New York City, and from Tokyo into the Middle East. The gold of the world. So economically, I don't want to just rehearse what you already know or beat a dead horse to death. I want to simply go systematically through the fact that right now, as a result of the Arab oil embargo and then the quadrupling of prices, economically, this world is in total chaos. And the really intelligent bankers who are at the head of world monetary funds and really try to negotiate and try to solve the problems of world monetary systems say that the world monetary system is in chaotic disarray. It needs to be completely revised from top to bottom. Economically, I'll just make the statement, the world is in a wretched mess, and it's going to get an awful lot worse before it gets any better. Militarily, the world is an armed camp. You've read now recently of the discovery of a Russian diesel-powered submarine. Many years ago, I wrote an article for the Plain Truth magazine in which I even characterized Alameda and the San Francisco area, and I was showing how there are Russian nuclear-powered submarines prowling up and down off our coast. And they're sometimes less than 100 miles out there. And I was just portraying the scene that goes on inside the bowels of this undersea prowler as it's beneath the waves. Doesn't have to surface like the old diesel-powered ones used to every night to charge their batteries. They can just stay under for immense periods of time. And how as they in yaw and pitch and roll and course changes are continually having the computers whirring and clicking away, making corrections on those nuclear-tipped warheads of these big missiles that are sitting in their silos inside this submarine. It's happening right this minute while we're here. At the same time, American submarines prowl off Weight of a Stalk or Archangel or up around the polar ice caps or maybe in the Mediterranean, and they ring the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union has submarines in the Gulf and over across on the Atlantic Ocean. And those nuclear-tipped missiles are aimed at all of our big cities, including as far inland as Denver. That includes certainly Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and Los Angeles and San Diego. I say militarily, the world is an armed camp. We now face the situation with increasing terrorism, sensational kidnappings, guerrilla attacks, commando maneuvers by various right or left-wing elements in country after country, Argentina, Peru, Venezuela, Israel, the Arab countries, even in Britain, North Ireland, increasingly inside the United States, sensational kidnappings. American diplomats have been kidnapped and shot. Recently, another man up near Cordoba in Venezuela, I should say in Argentina, where this occurred. So now we know that even nuclear weapons could fall into the hands of terrorist organizations. So now we have to take into account not only the strategic problems of a nuclear bomb world in which we have nearly 50 times overkill, but we have to look at a time when perhaps some submarine captain himself, under the incredible strain of staying 30 days at a time submerged, and the strain and the pressure of the job and of knowing that at any moment he might be discovered or that at any moment nuclear war might break out, why can't he go off his rocker? A lot of other people do. Why can't he break from the strain? Why couldn't he himself blackmail an entire nation by sending a warning message that he is going to obliterate so many cities unless such and such occurs? We follow along with this and we think about the possibility of terrorists who might even hijack bombers or submarines or other vessels with nuclear weapons aboard. We have to face the fact that more than 50% of America's nuclear arsenal is inside Europe, inside West Germany and Belgium and France, and it's not even in the United States. A tremendous percentage is in the air at any one time. It's aboard ships. So they've had to come up with new language to discover how to make it meaningful to our minds, how to relate to us as just common flesh, familiar with World War II, at least historically. How do we comprehend what is contained in one of these nuclear bomb warheads? So they've come up with brand new terminology, and they say, well, one of our supersonic bombers can carry in its bomb bay two World War IIs. Or one of the Soviet missiles can carry three World War IIs. That's with MERS. Now, you know what that means. That means the explosive equivalent of all of the destructive force unleashed by all participants in the entirety of World War II, and that in one nuclear device. I say that that defies human understanding. When I tell you that it takes an atomic bomb to ignite a hydrogen bomb, and tell you that that is the equivalent of about half of all the explosive force unleashed by all participants in World War II, I think I'm just dealing in meaningless language I'm not even sure I understand. I'm just saying that we live in a time right now tonight where we need to think, at least for the moment, for the purpose of what I have to say, that we face the potential in the years, in the months ahead of us, of war by chance, war by accident or war by design. And that if we begin to become involved in another war and it becomes nuclear in nature, it could be the very last one, and there will not be another man, woman, or child left alive on the earth when it's all over. So first, economically, the world is in economic chaos. Militarily, it's an armed camp and could blow up, and there are going to be 40 more nations possessing nuclear weapons in the years just ahead. Ecologically, a vast story. We could talk for a year and never cover the subject of pollution of air and water and solids, of destroying the ability of the earth to even create oxygen at its source, the diatoms of the sea and living green things. Now, the newly discovered destruction of the ozone layer around the earth that protects us from outer space and from various rays and so on. And yet even the unleashing of some of the gases in our harmless little spray cans, of which there are spray cans for almost everything, threatens the destruction of this ozone layer. And it's very possible that in the years just ahead, it takes them a long time to act, you may find hairsprays and all kinds of deodorants and everything absolutely banned in that particular form. It's just that dangerous. We have managed to put together poisonous chemical compounds which can virtually never be destroyed. At the bottom of the sea lies tens of thousands of tons of the mustard gas and of the other harmful and deadly gases that were not used during World War I. At the bottom of the sea lies tens of thousands of tons of gases and harmful toxic chemicals that were not used in World War II. Stored in our mountain fastness of Colorado, of New Mexico and other areas are other such repositories of deadly toxic poisons, of biological living poisons, which one of which is called a botulinum toxin, which is like botulism that you hear about. They claim a teaspoonful of that spread systematically in the air over an entire continent could kill everybody there. And these things exist. It's been some years since you heard of the leaking underground into the water table in Colorado, and miles away, thousands of sheep and cattle are dying, and finally they discover exactly what they're dying from and trace it to a leak of some of this hideously toxic poison in some military reservation miles from where these sheep are eating grass and drinking the water. It's polluting the very water table. I'm just reminding you of what you basically already know. So we're destroying the Earth's resources. There are endless statistics on this. Now, recently I've had some of the interviews from those who have been at the World Food Conference on Rome, Ray Kosanke, Henry Sturkey, and others who are over there, and also down at the OPEC Conference in Algiers. You remember the spectacle, and I think I addressed that both on television and radio, of some of the third world countries who deny there is such a thing as a population explosion. Why? Well, because group instinct and tribalism, ultra-rightism, nationalism, patriotism, chauvinism, the selfish interest of one nation, basically racism. And they say that this is a contrivance of the United States because we don't want these other countries to become so great in their populace that finally we become a little diminished, tiny nation or cease to exist, and then they have their great heyday and their great time in the sun, and they become fully developed, and they inherit all the problems we've got. So we have made this all up. There isn't any such thing as a population explosion. Well, if there is no such thing as a population explosion, why do they die by the millions in Bangladesh and India and China and the periphery of Southeast Asia, Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia? Why are people living at an absolute starvation level? Why in the sub-Sahara are they dying by the tens of thousands while we sit here day after day? You can see children in India, as I have seen, up to age 7, who cannot walk. They have no strength left. They have to crawl on their hands and knees. They cannot stand up because of protein deficiency. I've seen these things with my own eyes. Yet, even though we continually support these countries, try to buy lovers abroad, spend our strength aimlessly and senselessly, and our government is still trying to do it, they're looking toward the United States as Atlas. We're supposed to shoulder all the problems of the entirety of the world. The world seems to be telling America, you are our last hope. But while they say that, they kick us in the shins and slap us in the face and stalk us in the eye and spit in our face and tell us how terrible we are. The free world is saying to us, produce, stockpile food, just like Joseph told the Egyptians, because you've got to be the one kingpin nation to feed all the rest of the world. They tell us, provide the military umbrella so that all the other developing third world countries can enjoy the security from the threat of communism or the threat of some other country. So we don't have to spend all of our money on a gigantic arms buildup. Witness Japan since 1945 until the present. They're telling us, bring or force a peaceful solution to the Middle East. Do you really think of it in that context? Which nation depends on somebody from Thailand or somebody from Chile or somebody from maybe Nepal or even from Japan or even from West Germany to go down to the Middle East and get the Arabs and the Jews to solve that problem? They look to the United States to do it, yet we've got a lot of characters that seem to think it's Get Kissinger Week. And why in the world people are so against Mr. Kissinger, I don't know. Of course he's got his faults and his problems. But right now, he is the only true statesman, a towering statesman stature that this world has got. And that's a fact. And there isn't any other man you know of who has been able to accomplish as much in this incredibly complex game, which is like a game sometimes, between nations. The world is saying to us, feed the world, clothe the world, protect the world, settle the world's problems and wars, and continue a generous foreign policy. Every country, whether a little developing country in Africa or elsewhere, Central or South America, Banana Republic, they know that if they visit President Ford, they can be guaranteed a handout. At the same time, they say recycle Arab oil investments and all other aid to help these less fortunate nations to keep from drowning in their own sea of red ink of deficit spending. Why? Because these countries have never learned, even as we have not learned, the difference between guns and butter. So in sum, the world in general, by the hundreds of nations, is saying, America, save us. America, bail us out. We've got to have your help. And I say that unless America first saves itself, unless we bail ourselves out, we're not going to be able to save anybody else. And America is in serious trouble. I'm going to turn to the book of Matthew. Some of you have heard me quote this time and time again. Jesus of Nazareth was asked, there would be signs about a time when he talked of a great earthquake, when there wouldn't be one stone left atop another in the city of Jerusalem. He talked about his second coming. He talked about signs in the heavens. He said, you shall see the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then lift up your eyes, for your redemption draws nigh. The disciples said, well, tell us, when is all this going to happen? They thought maybe it would happen right away. So he said, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. I won't elaborate on that. That's what you hear of every single day. The Middle East, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, elsewhere in the world. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines. I have asked time and again, what is there that is religious about this part of the Bible? People all of a sudden get into a religious attitude. Now, I'm reading from the Bible, so it's religious time. I'm supposed to change my voice and say it in a sick tone. It says there shall be famines. What is religious about a famine? What is religious about an earthquake? About a drought? About a flood? About a fire or a windstorm? A tornado? About what the Bible says is pestilence, which is disease epidemics? Is that religious? Here's a statement by a man, let's put it in its proper context, who was walking this earth as a human being who said he was the Son of God nearly 2,000 years ago. His own disciples believed that he was the Son of God. But when he was killed, they lost all their confidence. It says they all forsook him and fled. There wasn't a one of them who still had hope. They were gung-ho while they were with him. They were companions and compadres. They were close friends. Even to the point that Peter on one occasion grabbed him by the shoulders and shook him and said, no, Lord, they're not going to get you. You and me, Lord, I'll stand them off. I won't let that happen to you. And Jesus had to rebuke Peter and say, Peter, you don't know what spirit you're of, or get thee behind me, Satan, a way of rebuking Peter, and said that he was going to have to suffer death, no matter what Peter said. But when he was crucified, they all forsook him and fled. It says every last one of them. Not only did Peter deny him, even using the name of God and cursing and saying, I never heard of that guy, but they literally took off and ran from that area. And they thought, it's all over. They killed him. It was good while it lasted. We had hoped that he would reestablish the kingdom, but we didn't think they could get away with killing him. They didn't understand what he had said. He was resurrected from the tomb, walked out of that tomb. Not a one of those disciples wanted to believe him. Every one of them doubted it. It said they all doubted. When the women and the others saw him, they thought that he was a gardener. Why? Well, because it was commonplace to hire a disfigured man. And here was a stooped over figure with perhaps horrible bruises and wounds and injuries showing plainly. Possibly one eye swollen clear shut and almost out of place. There were no bones broken, but the flesh was horribly disfigured. They thought he was a gardener. Maybe you haven't read those accounts. Maybe you haven't read all the accounts of how he appeared to 500 people at the same time. The accounts of how he made them believe that he was alive and had been resurrected. Those disciples who were then apostles began to really believe that Jesus Christ was alive, that he had walked out of his tomb. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 said it was by many infallible proofs, including 500 people at the same time. And when he wrote that, most of those people were still alive. The Corinthian church who read that epistle could easily have written a letter and tested every single one of those claims. Could have said to any one of those people, "Did you really see what you saw?" Later he appeared personally to the Apostle Paul. Jesus said that he was going to be resurrected. He said he would be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Nobody believes that today. That's another subject. It has to do with this holiday. But Ishtar, the original pronunciation might have been. Ishtar, a Babylonian word. But the truth of the Bible was 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the tomb, and that was the only sign that Jesus left as a perennial witness that he was the true Son of God, that he was going to be resurrected. That he was not only prophesying what would happen, but he would be in heaven with the power to bring it about. You see, people think that Jesus was just looking on into the future and saying, "I think this is going to happen, and that's going to happen." And once having prophesied, that's the end of it. It's written down, and Jesus is sitting back, and he's hoping that maybe it will go the way he said. No, but you see, Jesus Christ walked out of the tomb, and he sits at the right hand of God, and he has the power to interfere and intervene in the course of human affairs and to bring about what he said. So he not only prophesied, but he also has the power to fulfill those prophecies. Jesus Christ of Nazareth is alive. You can prove that. You can prove it by logic, by history, by the internal evidence of the Bible. It even has to do with the Old Testament dates, to do with the building of the Temple of Herod, to do with the beginning of his ministry. Jesus Christ of Nazareth talked about all the things that are happening right now. There is nothing religious about what's going on in world economy or about the pouring of gold and all the wealth of the world into the Middle East. Yet I can turn to this prophecy over here in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, which I'll do right quickly, and just read a few verses. At the time of the end. Now, what is that? I'm not going to run up and down with a placard or a sign and say, "This is the time of the end, flee from the wrath to come." But I do believe in my very being that this is the time of the end. I don't know if that means that the United States will recover from the present slump and we're going to have another 2 or 3 good years and it'll all blow apart in 78 or 9. I would guess that that's going to be true. But that may be a terribly bad guess. We may have a few more years to do God's work before all this comes crashing down around our ears. I don't know. That's the point. I'm no expert. I'm no more an expert on world news than you are. I have to get the same sources you do. I can read the same scriptures that you can read. And I can't come to any different conclusions than you can come to. Jesus said, "Wars and rumors of wars, we've got them." He said, "Drought and famine, we've got them." He said, "Earthquakes in diverse places," and they are growing in intensity and frequency, and they're warning of great big ones to come. And he's saying, "The end of the times of the Gentiles," and I can prove to you, at least within a few years, without setting dates, that we're nearing the end of the times of the Gentiles. Now, we live in the time so serious, just in the offing, of these many events in a whole global sense. I'm trying to give you the overview to think of the economy, of government, of the military, of the ecology, of the religious aspects, but primarily of the moving of one major world event as it overlaps and affects and has play upon every other major world event. Here we are, the Middle East is an armed camp. Armies surround Jerusalem. The gold of the world is pouring into the Persian Gulf chiefdoms. Here is this prophecy of the king of the south who pushes that. That's a jostling, a shoving. It's not a military attack. So in a very vivid sense, these prophecies of the Bible kind of leap to life in a new instant sense in today's world news as they never have before. Now, where do we stand in world conditions then? I say we stand just barely at the time before the king of the south pushes at the king of the north. But maybe to take it one step further, where we are is just barely before the emergence of a person who will be called, in biblical language, the king of the north. I think the next thing to happen is a deep, deep depression. And maybe it'll strike all around. I think it will here as well. Maybe it's going to be off 2 or 3 or 4 years. And I hope that it is, frankly. But when it does, I know enough about what has happened in the backdrop of the 1923 clear on through into World War II in Germany. I know enough about the German mentality and the German people and how in a time of desperation they always turn to an iron-fisted strong man. That when the economies of country after country begin to utterly come apart and just collapse, those countries will turn to a dictator, to an iron-fisted ruler to try to get them out of those problems. And that is when you're going to begin to see what I call the beast power develop in Central Europe. And you're going to begin to see the emergence of a strong leader, a world stature leader, who is at once a military and political leader in Europe. And I believe you're also going to see far more strong statements coming out of the mouth of a person who sits in a city, as the Bible says in Revelation 17, has seven hills, and so on. And you just have to read what the Bible says, and you wrestle with it. I don't want to embarrass anybody here at this moment, but I believe we're just now barely before verse 40 of the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. And I believe with all of my being that we don't have another decade. I don't think we got another 15 years to wait around. Think about it, brethren. I really don't. I think we are within months or a very few years of the events that we read of here just bursting upon the world scene. Now, what are you supposed to be doing about it? Well, that's up to you entirely. We'll fold up our tent, we say, and go down the road and probably never see you again. This same audience would never in any stretch of the imagination be here exactly made up as this one is at any time in the future. I have said time and again over the radio and over television that we live in the time of the end. Then I tell people what the solution is. Then I get a letter and people say, well, Armstrong gives us doomsday and he gives us a shotgun approach to the world economy and politics and tells us what all the problems are, but he never tells us what the solution is. The solution is that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is going to come back to this earth. That he's going to rend the heavens and step out onto this earth, and his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. The solution is what he told the disciples, I'm coming again. I'm talking of Jesus who literally exists, who is alive, who is going to come back to the earth, and who is going to rule it with a rod of iron, who is going to be the greatest dictator you ever saw. Benevolent, loving, absolutely friendly, willing to forgive. I'm not saying you will believe it, but I want you to get it straight that you don't have to believe it to bring it to pass. And I could be standing here all night telling you it's not going to happen. And it'll happen anyway. It'll happen anyway because it's going to happen.
You've been listening to Garner Ted Armstrong's personal appearance program in San Francisco. For more information on today's world events and the good news beyond, request your free subscription to Plain Truth, the twice-monthly journal of understanding. Plain Truth. There's no cost or obligation.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.